Esme looked up as Major Patak came in from a briefing.
Bad news. Security's found a body stuffed in a utility closet on Deck 8T2. And it was someone who'd had a pink tag. Neck broken, neatly and professionally. Also, they've got a hostage. Maybe. Ensign Serrano.
Baron!
He was sent to get something out of inventory. None of the automated systems are running, and never came back. When his unit went looking for him, they found a harness tucked into the rack he'd have been on, and a smear of blood. As if there'd been more, and someone had been careless wiping it up.
They'd have had to knock him out to take him.
So you'd think. Commander Jarls and Commander Voorhees are both furious, and nearly got into a flaming row right there at the briefing. Why was he sent alone? Why didn't someone raise the alarm sooner, and so on? The Admiral was not happy with them, to put it mildly. The Captain? I don't even want to discuss. Scuttlebutt has it that he'd got crosswise of a Serrano 20-odd years ago. If that kid gets killed aboard his ship, he's going to have the whole family down on him.
But Ensign Serrano is surely more important than any feud.
Even as Esme said that, she knew it was wrong. Family was family, but a family would not jeopardize its standing for a single individual. Hers hadn't.
He's one ensign, on a ship with over 25,000 personnel. The captain can't let concerns about Serrano affect his primary concern, the safety of his ship. You've spent some time with him recently, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
Something going on there?
Not really. We're just friends.
It sounded as lame and false as it felt. What had she been feeling around Baron? She hadn't done any of the things that regulations prohibited between senior and junior officers in a chain of command, even though they weren't in the same chain of command. But she had, if she was honest, wanted to do some of those things. If he did. He had never indicated that he did. She forced herself to look Patak in the eye.
After he helped me at that briefing for the senior tactical discussions group, we talked a few times. I liked him. He knew a lot of things about fleet, which they never taught us in school.
I'd noticed some changes. Coaching you, was he?
Yes. Admiral Serrano and others had mentioned that I confused, I think was their term, people because of mannerisms which are normal on Altiplano. Baron was able to define what I was doing wrong.
I wouldn't say exactly wrong.
And show me what the fleet customs were.
I see.
Patak rocked back and forth in her chair for a long moment, staring past Esme's elbow.
Sweeza, everything in your record says you're level-headed and not a troublemaker, but you've never had a partner that anyone knows about, have you?
Direct challenge got the answer out of her before she realized she was giving it.
No. No, I just didn't.
Huh. And you're not on any medication that would explain it, are you?
No, sir.
Sweeza, you're 10 years too old for this advice, but in some ways, if I didn't know better, I'd think you were 10 years younger. So try to take it as well meant. You're ripe for a fall, and Baron's the only male you've spent more than a work shift with. Whether you know it or not, you're on the slide now.
No, I won't.
There's nothing wrong with it, Sweeza. You're only a lieutenant, he's an ensign, that's a fairly common level of difference. You're not his commander. The only problem is, he's now in enemy hands, and we've got an emergency. I need your brain clear, your emotions steady. No racing off to do useless heroics or try to rescue your lover.
Lover?
Esme's heart pounded. Her stomach was doing free fall into her boots.
He's not...
Young woman, whether you have actually been skin to skin or not, he is the first man you've cared about since you were grown. That's clear enough. Admit it, and you'll deal with it better.
Esme had had those vague wishes, those inchoate fantasies. Baron's hands would not be like those other hands. The uniform was different. She dragged herself away from all that and fought down the flutter in her diaphragm.
I do care. A lot. What happens to him? We hadn't talked about anything else.
All right. Now you've faced it. And now you have to face this. You and I have nothing to do with the search for Baron. For the intruders, for anything else. It's our job to get Wraith back in service before a Blood Horde battle group pops out here and blows us all away, or worse, captures us. Whatever happens to Baron Serrano cannot be as bad as the capture of this ship by the enemy. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
It was clear, in the part of her mind that was free to think clearly. The word capture rang in her mind with the finality of steel on stone. If they did not do their work, They might all be captives. And she knew she could not handle that. The vision sparkled in her mind. The quiet, competent, ordinary Lieutenant Sweeza going completely and irrevocably crazy the moment she became a captive again. However much she cared for Baron, she could not let that happen.
Good. I didn't think you'd do anything foolish, but the little I know about Altiplano suggests that you might have triggers set which would push you into some stupid rescue attempt.
They are going to try one, though, aren't they?
Major Patak looked away.
I don't know. The most critical thing is to find the intruders before they do any significant damage. Rescuing one ensign has to be a lower priority. What's really twisting the captain's tail is the fear that they'll disable the self-destruct.
The self-destruct?
Yes, the captain is not about to let us be captured by the Blood Horde. They could build cruisers with this facility and the expertise of our people. He's told the admirals that he'll blow us up first.
Good.
Patak looked at her oddly.
Most of us aren't happy about that. We admit the necessity, but you like it?
Better than captivity.
Well, you never cease to amaze, Sweeza. Since your brain seems to be working well enough, I'll answer some questions you'll no doubt ask in 5 minutes if I don't. We aren't jumping out of the system because we can't. I don't know why. It might be that the intruders sabotaged the FTL drive. It might be that the fast sequence jumps we did coming in shook something loose. Drives and maneuver is on it. I need you to do a search, since you're good at that. If we assume that the fast sequence jumps cause some structural damage or shift, what would it be?
Yes, sir.
If you come up with anything, buzz me. We've got those Wraith structural supports coming over the line, and I need to be there for the installation.
Patak started out the door, and then turned back.
Oh, yes. The new procedures are that no one goes anywhere alone, and that includes the head. We know that at least one of the intruders now has a current ID badge. No doubt, they'd like more. The captain may decide to firewall the ship, but right now there's not enough security personnel to man the access points. We're supposed to be alert for any strangers, anyone we're not used to seeing around. Though on a ship this size, that's not much use. I certainly wouldn't know half the instructors over in T1 by sight, let alone the students. This is going to be a real bitch to implement. Rekeying thousands of IDs every day and rechecking all personnel they're given to. All of us wearing tag tails, all of us going around in bunches.
Are we all going to move into open base for sleeping?
I hope not. I can't sleep like that anymore. I'm old enough to be wakened by snorers. But it may come to that, though it means leaving a lot of compartments vacant, which can only help the intruders. Anyway, the captain's asked the flags for more personnel for security. And I understand that there were words exchanged about that between our admiral and Levati. But we've got to get Wraith back in action. If, as we suspect, there's a Blood Horde battle group coming here to pick us off, we'll need every bit of help we can get.
Is that possible? I mean, you said it would take...
longer than we have, I know. Hull repairs alone should run 60 to 70 days. Then there's refitting the internal systems, installing the weapons, testing, but there's nothing else to do. Maybe they'll be late. Maybe they'll get lost. Maybe our fleet will come back. Or maybe they'll get the self-destruct fixed and we won't have to worry about anything. At least those of us who don't believe in an afterlife. Do you? Is that why you think it's a good idea?
Not exactly.
Esme didn't believe in the afterlife her great-grandmother had taught her about, where the dead were placed on the level they'd earned like pots of flowers on a stand. But she found it hard to imagine nothingness. An absolute end. Patak looked as if she'd like to say something more, but left without another word. Esme looked at her screen a moment, and then at the bulkhead. Baron a hostage? Baron dead? She could not imagine either of those. Not Baron, so brimful of energy, so much a Serrano. It was not her assignment, Patak had warned her. But... of all the people on this ship, she was the one who had actually fought on shipboard. She was thinking the wrong things. She wasn't thinking at all. She scolded herself for letting a brief experience of command turn her head. With a ship full of admirals on down, they weren't going to let a lieutenant in hull and architecture do anything but look up statistics in computer files.
Huh?
Baron had dozed off, but woke when he heard an approaching noise, thinking it was help, maybe. Instead, it was another of the intruders, with two men and a woman in civilian clothes. Baron knew, in a general way, who they were. Civilian technical advisors, experts, contractors, hired to do something in weapons systems. He'd never actually met any of them, though he'd seen them in the corridors and lift tubes occasionally. Ordinary, middle-aged civilians, he'd thought. Of no interest to him, since they weren't working in his area. Now they stared at him as if he were a monster, too. He supposed he looked pretty bad, with his swollen nose and bruised face. But they didn't have to look as if they thought it was all his fault.
You lied to us. You were paid to fix this, and you didn't. When we looked, the lights were green.
But we did fix it. We fixed it so that it wouldn't work, but the captain would think it did work. That's why all the telltales are green. He could run his system test, and it would come up...
They're not green now.
What happened?
The man leaned past his captor to look, and turned an interesting shade of pale green.
You... did you tear those wires out?
To make sure it wouldn't work? Yes, because you lied to us.
But I didn't lie. Now he knows it doesn't work, and he could have a backup.
You were supposed to disable all self-destruct devices. You were paid to do that. So, if you left one, then you have broken your word to us, and we take that very seriously.
We don't know. We did what you said.
The man looked as if he couldn't quite believe the situation. He kept glancing at Baron and away again.
Fix it again so that it looks to the captain as if it's working.
But the captain will know it's been tampered with. Fixing it now won't convince him. Someone would have to tell him. I could go tell him I could fix it. They know we're experts in weapons systems, and then I could...
The man didn't have time to flinch away before he was dying, the blade deep in his throat and a hard hand squeezing his mouth. Blood spurted, then flowed, then stopped, filling the compartment with the smell of blood so strong it almost covered the stench of death itself. The killer let the dead man fall and then wiped his bloody hand across his own mouth, then the woman's.
They don't call us the Blood Horde for nothing!
With the same knife... and it seemed even worse to Baron that he didn't wipe it clean between the killing and the mutilation. He sliced off the dead man's left ear, bit it hard once, and then tucked it away in his uniform. He turned to the second civilian.
Now, you will fix this so it looks as if it's working.
The second man, shorter and darker haired than the other, hurried to comply. When he had done... the telltales showed green again.
That's got it.
The killer turned to the woman.
Is this right?
Yes. Yes. Yes, it is right.
If you know that, we don't need him.
The killer caught the smaller man by the collar.
We'd rather work with you.
No! Let him go, please!
We heard what you said about the Blood Horde. How you taunted our agent. You dared to bind him. You threatened. You had a noose around his neck. And now you have a noose around your neck. Even barbarians, as you call us, understand poetic justice.
The killer twisted, and horribly, slowly, the dapper little man died, his struggles weaker and weaker until they ceased. The killer turned to the woman.
We pay our debts. Do we think size is everything? I believe that was your complaint, was it not? Then I believe you should have a chance to experience size in a way suitable to you in particular.
The woman gave Baron a frantic glance.
You think he could help you? This boy that we captured as easily as we took you?
No!
Through all that followed, Baron struggled, grasping his wrists raw, earning a random cuff now and then from men more amused than concerned with his efforts. The woman struggled too, but it did her no good. One after another, they took her, in ways that Baron's inexperience had not imagined. Finally, the woman lay still. Baron couldn't tell if she was dead or just unconscious. She had been some kind of traitor, apparently. He had gotten that much from what they'd all said, but no one deserved what had happened to her. One of the men tapped the other on the shoulder and pointed at Baron. The one on her pushed himself up and then turned to Baron, He grinned even wider.
That boy's upset. Maybe she was his girl.
Too old. A nice boy like him wouldn't have a woman like that.
I'm sure he has a girl somewhere on the ship. We'll have to be sure we find her.
Baron would have heaved again if he'd had anything left. Captain Haken looked around the conference room, shaking his head.
What I don't understand is how they found the self-destruct so fast. Not that many people know where it is.
They grabbed those civilian contractors.
But how would they know? They're weapons specialists. They've been busy recalibrating the guidance systems. Oh, shit.
If someone suborned the civilians, then they could have disabled the self-destruct. They could have found it while appearing to be working on weapons and inventory.
What I don't understand is why they were snatched if they've already done their job.
They hadn't. Remember, until an hour ago, all the signals were secure.
Commander Weitsch looked up from his weapons data.
Considering the quality of work they did on the weapons, if they disabled it, I'd expect it to be undetectable. I'd bet they were snatched simply for their weapons expertise. With the data wands the intruders got from the three we know they killed, they'd have high enough access to find that out.
So now the self-destruct is out of my control. I should have used it.
No. It was the handiest way, the easiest and least obvious way for you to have the power of destruction. But it wasn't the only. On this ship, with what we've got in inventory and the expertise in the 14th alone, we can prevent capture. We will.
I hope so. I sincerely hope so. Because if you don't, we are not the only ones who will suffer for it.
Wraith gives us another possibility.
Wraith?
She still has a third of her weapons, all in portside mountings. And she still has ample firepower to blow cars. Not from the repair bay. The way she's locked into the cradles, even if she blew herself, there's a 72% chance that most of Kos would survive. We'd have to reposition her mounts, which would take days. But if we can get her into a position to fire on the core area...
Commander Takis, head of drives and maneuver, made an outraged, dismissive gesture.
She can't maneuver! We dismounted the drives when she first came in, and it would take days to remount them. Besides, I have everyone working on the FTL drive for this ship.
I was thinking of the drive's test cradle. She doesn't have to maneuver to be slung on there and then towed into position, even if you wish, at the extremity of the lines. The test cradle's own drive would be sufficient, if necessary, to move her into the best firing position for Kos. Or she could get some shots off at the Blood Horde.
It could work. Certainly as far as destroying Kos is concerned, and quite probably she could do a fair bit of damage to the Blood Horde ships.
If those weapons have not been taken off Wraith, and we're absolutely sure they haven't been tampered with, then we've got our failsafe back. As long as they're not depleted taking pot shots at the enemy.
No. I can see that there'd have to be strict limits of use, but that should leave enough to do some damage. Especially if we had something else. One of the shuttles, maybe. In the Xavier action, the planetary defense used a couple of shuttles to good effect.
They used them for mine laying. I don't think that would work here.
If only we could Trojan horse them, the way they did to us. It would serve the bastards right.
Get aboard a Blood Horde ship? I don't see how. Since they do it, they know it can be done. They'd be watching. And our people would be trying a hostile boarding against resistance.
I was thinking... If we had any native speakers of their language, if we could locate one of these intruders and sweat some recognition codes out of them, then our people could pretend to be their own team coming back.
Won't work. Sorry, sir, but we shouldn't waste time with schemes bound to fail. The Blood Horde Special Operations Teams, which is what we have aboard, are all members of one lineage. Each team is, I mean. They train together for years and develop their own distinctive dialect. Our people can't imitate a Blood Horde pack. Not without a lot of training. We don't have time to give. Besides, we only have 13 people aboard who speak the language with anything like sufficient fluency, and their accents indicate different origins.
We're at the brainstorming stage, Commander Norris. There are no bad ideas.
Very well, sir. Well, suppose one of the Blood Horde ships were close in and empty or nearly empty of its crew. We've developed a fairly good model of a Blood Horde ship's control systems, working from the commercial models they're built on, and information from Scavenge. It wouldn't take long to train our experienced warship crews to use it. Or, for that matter, import our own scan equipment.
And just where do you plan to find a close-in Blood Horde ship with its crew off it?
The question hung a moment as they all considered. Then the same idea flickered across several faces. Haken's turned grim.
No, absolutely not. I am not going to allow more Blood Horde troops aboard my ship, just for the chance of capturing one of theirs.
They'd probably like to use one of the repair bays. Wraith's in one, they know that. The other's empty. The best place for a smaller ship to dock anyway. Full of stuff they want.
No!
Do you have any information on Blood Horde boarding procedures, Commander?
All we have is reports from the few civilians who survived a Blood Horde raid on a large civilian ship. They come in wearing protective gear that functions as both EVA and battle armor. They were, in that case, quite willing to damage the ship they'd captured to gain control of it. None of the civs we talked to could tell one level of weapon from another, but one of them did describe something capable of holing interior bulkheads with one shot. Here, though, we're assuming they want a DSR entire. I expect they'll do as little damage as possible in capturing it, but they do have to board.
Another possibility is the weaponry aboard a Blood Horde ship in a repair bay. Suppose it could be immobilized there. Then its weapons would give us yet another self-destruct capability. They have forward-mounted weapons in every class.
If we were able to get aboard and take control...
I think we can take that as given, sir. If they just sit there, they aren't accomplishing anything. They can't shoot at us without doing the damage they don't want. And besides, they have no reputation for being patient. I think we can count on them coming out with an intent to take control of key systems.
Which is why we can't let them do it. It would take your people some time to get aboard, get control of their ship, and maybe be able to use it to defeat their other ships or destroy us. And in the meantime, I'd have a ship full of enemy. No!
So the real problem is getting them off their ship without letting them onto ours. You know, there might be a way. If we could shut off the repair bay, that whole wing...
We could just take it apart.
Take it apart?!
Commander Ceviche, review the original construction data and all later modifications. There may be a way to cut one of the repair bays loose, unobtrusively, of course, and isolate it from the rest of Kosciusko.
In less than an hour, Ceviche returned with the data ready to display. He set up the large screen and lit it.
Here, you see. When they assembled Kos, they planned for possible changes by using temporary attachments.
You mean we've been working in a ship that's not really held together?
No, sir. It is held together, and quite well. But it would take only hours, not days, to detach it again. These pressure clamps, these connectors here, all this can be undone fairly easily. Relatively, I mean. The seal between T4 and the core cylinder is a large expansion joint of sorts.
Ceviche switched to another display.
As Kos was assembled, before an arm was locked on, the near end of these things were fastened to the core, and then the outer end to the arm. As the arms moved in to mate with the corrugations compressed, giving additional safety margin to the join.
Yes, but I presume you plan to stretch them out again. Do you really expect them to be sound after all this time?
I don't see why not. We've used the same material over the same span of time, with multiple compressions and extensions, with no failure. Besides, we can have the locks on each side shut. The way the arms are made, there are airlocks on the inner end of each deck.
I know that, Commander, but I'm sure they'll notice that the inner hatches are locked, and then they'll blast them.
No, they won't. We can rig temporary cross-dock access. They don't know what it's supposed to look like.
Then when it detaches, it'll depressurize.
Not if someone is there to lock the hatches.
Ceviche looked to Dossignol for help.
We're going to take casualties, whatever we do. To protect us from capture, you're prepared to destroy the ship and crew. I understand that, and it may be necessary. But I believe we have a chance to save both the ship and much of its crew if we can hold out until Admiral Garrosh returns. Denying the enemy the use of a ship, using it ourselves, and using what firepower Wraith has left is the only way I see to do that. I'm sure we'll have volunteers enough for the most hazardous of these hazardous missions.
We'll have to have someone commanding each section that's freed, with the authority to do what they must, whatever that is. Divided command would be disastrous, and we can't be sure that communications will hold.
Which means we've got to get those people involved in planning right away.
I don't like it. It's Scrabble law. The whole ship is my command, and you're proposing to break off pieces and give them an independent command. Separated, they'll be even easier meat to the invaders.
Captain, we're offering a suggestion that gets us both off the hook. Kosciusko was assembled from previously independent sections in deep space. You know that. T4 and T3 even had names. Peace and Meal may have been stupid names, but names. they might have been commissioned as ships in their own right if Fleet had not decided to try for a unified DSR. It's reasonable to maintain that they're both directly under the 14th.
You'll have to crew them. You're not taking any of the crew I need to secure Kos.
You know, Vladis, if it's really going to stick in your craw, you can write a report.
Oh, I intend to. Partly to question your authority to nominate a captain for any vessel in this sector. That's Foxworth's job. Or, at the lowest level, Garrosh's.
I see your point. But I'm gonna do it anyway. We can all hash it out with a board of inquiry, if not a court, later.
It won't improve the odds, and it just makes my job harder.
I don't see how, since we're almost certainly ridding you of most your intruders and one of the ships trying to attack you. Now, as for crew, we have the uninjured survivors of Wraith.
Which will be needed to serve Wraith's weapons.
Their weapons crew, certainly. Since Wraith won't be maneuvering, I don't know about their bridge crew. I hate to waste a captain with combat experience aboard a crippled ship. We're not overburdened with such officers.
Commander Adarin held out a data wand.
Admiral, I've prepared a list of all officers and enlisted aboard with combat experience in the past 3 years. They're rank ordered by specialty and in performance, not just experience in combat.
Good. Let's see. Oh my.
Haken craned his neck, trying to see.
What?
We have ample combat experienced weapons specialists because the senior weapons technical course is running. Scan, not much problem there. We're short environmental systems specialists, but this should be over fast enough that it won't be critical. We can have our people in self-contained gear. Communications is also short, but most scan techs are cross-trained in communications, and we have plenty of scan techs. What we don't have is ship commanders. Or rather, we have just enough. Wraith's captain for Wraith and Lieutenant Commander Bowry, who's here for a special course, to command the Bloodhorde ship.
I don't suppose we'd be lucky enough to get more than one of them.
I doubt it. Why would they bring in more than one ship at a time? If they gifted us with such riches, we'd just have to find someone to take it. But that gets us down to fairly junior officers with very little experience of command in combat.
Dossignol considered telling them who, precisely, but he knew Haken would have particular objections to Esme Sweeza. Esme found what might be a possible cause of the failure of the FTL drives and took that to Major Patak, who was overseeing the transport of the long crystal bundles from the Special Materials Fabrication Unit to T3 and Wraith. Even bundled, they were more flexible than Esme had expected. As she watched, the special transport teams eased them along the transport track. She had known, intellectually, that all ships had such framing members. She had known that they had a lateral flexibility which was essential to the design. But these shivering, wriggling lengths seemed far too frail to trust lives to in deep space. Patak gave her a brief glance and turned back to watch.
Ah, Sweeza, find something?
It's only a possibility.
Good enough. Have you seen these before? Wiggly, aren't they?
More than I thought.
Vidscan screens showed the entire route, from the exit port at the end of the Specmat fab, up over T1, the core, and down again between T3 and T4.
Why didn't they put the repair bays on the same side of the ship as Specmat? Wouldn't it have been easier to transfer things like that?
Yes, but that turned out to be the least important design consideration. If it really interests you, when this crisis is over, you can look it up in the design archives. The whole argument is in there.
Patak punched up the view in one screen and pointed to the bundles.
Now that's a good set. After a while, you'll be recognizing good strands from bad by the oscillations alone. If we didn't have this other crisis, I'd send you over to Specmat to watch them during breakoff.
Esme was just as glad to miss that. She had heard from others about the more spectacular breakoffs, when the test sequences induced more oscillation than a faulty crystal could withstand, and shards flew with a noise that was said to shake reason.
Let me see what you've got.
Patak looked at the data Esme had found and frowned.
I don't think this is it. The shearing force isn't enough to unseat the AG generators. And you're suggesting that it was AG instability which caused the drive failure, right?
Yes, sir.
How does it model?
They bumped everyone below department heads off the big computer. The little one said it was possible. That's why I brought it.
Ah. Well, I don't like the modeling program on the little one for anything but structural layups. For this sort of thing, we need the Mishnazi series. You should log off and get some sleep while you can. At least a good meal. Have you kept track of who's been to dinner?
No, sir. but I can do that as soon as I get back.
Do that then, and thanks for this. I think it's sabotage myself, but DNM asked us to consider it.
Esme nodded and withdrew with her escort. A corporal she'd yanked out of the H&A clerical section when she needed to find Patak. She hated feeling useless. Of course she should eat. Of course she should be making sure that everyone else in the section did. But she wanted to do more. She had just reached Patak's office and started checking on the whereabouts of all personnel under her command when the comm beeped at her.
Right in the middle of a crisis and they have to short me. Sweeza, what have you been doing to get the Admirals interested in you?
Nothing that I know of.
Well, you're to report to Admiral Dasignal's office immediately. And the note to me says not to expect you back anytime soon. It never fails. I get someone trained to the point where they can do me some good and the brass taketh away.
Sorry, Major.
Too late, Esme remembered that she wasn't supposed to apologize. She thought of Baron with a pang. Was he still alive? Was he all right?
Better get going. If you have a chance, let me know what's going on. There's an odd feeling in this ship.
Yes, sir.
In the Admiral's outer office, Commander Adarin was watching for her.
Ah, Lieutenant Sweeza. Good. We're going directly to a secure meeting room in T1. Our escort will meet us at the lift tube.
Sir, may I ask...
Not until we're there. And don't look alarmed. You aren't in trouble, and we don't want to scare anyone.
Yes, sir.
Two armed pivot majors with security patches waited by the lift tubes. Esme saw the sheen of perspiration on their faces.
Commander, the captain says it would be better to avoid the tubes.
Something happened?
I can't say, sir.
Let's go, then.
Esme and Commander Adarin followed as he led them around the core to the base of T1. The wide passageway was busier than usual, as if others were avoiding the lift tubes and slideways. They had 5 decks of ladders to climb. When they emerged from the last, Esme saw another pair of security guards, these with their weapons in hand outside a secured hatch. A portable ID booth had been set up nearby, and Esme noticed the heavy gray boxes and cables of a full-strength blanket system positioned along the bulkhead. Whatever this was about, it was being kept as secure as possible from intrusion. She and Adarin both went through a complete ID check, retinal scans, palm prints, and blood test. Then the guards at the door checked them in. Inside, the medium-sized conference room was edged with more scan blanketing equipment. In the center, a cluster of officers leaned over a large table with a 3D model of Kosciusko on it. Esme already knew Admirals Dasignal and Levati by sight, as well as Captain Haken, but she had not met the lean, gray-haired full commander who was introduced as Wraith's captain, or his exec, Lieutenant Commander Freeze. Another lieutenant commander named Bowry, who wore no ship patch, had a collar pin indicating he was in the senior technical schools for some course.
What is this?
Gentlemen.
Admiral Dasignal now seated himself at one end of the table. Esme saw that places had been prepared with name tags, hers near the far end of the table. She sat just as the others did.
As you know, we are in a difficult situation here. In a few minutes, you'll have a chance to review the details of that situation. But the first thing you need to know is that you are all immediately relieved of your former assignments. You are assigned, under my direct command, to a difficult and dangerous mission. This is the first of the meetings you will hold to plan the execution of this mission.
He paused, as if for comment, but no one was unwise enough to make any.
You also need to know that Captain Haken is not in agreement with the aim of this mission, and plans to file a letter of protest. I respect his moral courage in so expressing his disagreement, and his loyalty, which has allowed him to cooperate even under protest.
Esme glanced at the captain, who went from beet red to pale.
I take full responsibility for what is done here, and its outcome. I have so informed Captain Haken, and have so stipulated in the official log. Is that clear? Good. Now, our mission is to capture a Blood Horde ship, and using that and Wraith, successfully defend this ship from capture. You are the officers who will command elements involved in this mission, so you are here to plan it.
But Wraith's crippled.
Correct. Wraith's drives are dismounted, and she cannot maneuver. But she can be trolled out to the drive test cradle, where her weapons can come to bear on either the Blood Horde ships or Kosciusko, as need requires.
Kosciusko?
If capture appears inevitable, Kosciusko must be destroyed. Its capability must not fall into Bloodhorde hands, nor must its thousands of skilled technicians.
Esme supposed the others had worked through this equation before. The Bloodhorde had never been known to free or exchange prisoners, though a few had been rescued from appalling conditions. Thus, a quick death, or relatively quick, would be a mercy compared to slavery on one of the Athar's world planets. But to contemplate the annihilation of so many of their own...
I believe, that there is a chance to defend this ship and prevent those deaths. It's not a good chance, but it is a chance. You are the ones best suited to carry it out. We do not know how much time we have. Let's not waste any.
With that, the planning session began in earnest. Esme had never been involved in mission planning before. She said nothing and listened, wondering how she fit into this. Admiral Dasignal outlined his ideas, then assigned officers to specific tasks.
Lieutenant Suiza, except for the crew of Wraith, you have the most recent and in some ways the most valuable combat experience.
Esme could feel them all staring at her.
Sir, the Admiral knows I was only...
This is no time for humility, Lieutenant. You are the only officer we've got who has actually fought inside a ship. And you commanded despite, with remarkable results. I'm not assigning you to command the ship we hope to capture. There's a more senior and more experienced officer. But I am calling on your knowledge of intra-ship combat.
Yes, sir.
At the same time, I think Captain Haken's security squads would benefit from your expertise.
Dasignal glanced at the captain, whose face reddened.
We have hostile forces aboard, and we've already taken casualties. Security hasn't located them or prevented the trouble they've caused so far.
If the Admiral wishes, my reservations are on file.
Commander Ceviche, you will be responsible for the actual detachment of T4 from the hub. I leave it to you how you're going to keep the necessary preparations for being recognized by the intruders, who I'm sure are observing what they can.
Yes, sir. I think some judicious tinkering with the artificial gravity controls could provide an excuse.
Whatever. If events overtake us before detachment is possible, we need a fallback plan. Along with your other duties, Lieutenant Suiza, I'd like you and Commander Adarin to liaise with Kosciusko's security about that. Commander Jimson, here to make sure that people get what they need out of inventory without letting any more personnel be captured.
We need more security personnel.
True, Captain. If it would help you, I'm sure that Admiral Avadi can suggest individuals now enrolled in one of the tech courses who have sufficient background to be useful and have been aboard long enough to know their way around.
I've had Commander Fearon make a list already. We have 28 enlisted personnel with a secondary specialty in ship security and another 34 who have done security work at some time or other within the past 10 years. All are currently qualified with shipboard small arms. In addition, we have more personnel in the remote sensing course than Admiral Dasignal thinks will be needed for the rest of this mission. They can improve surveillance.
I must emphasize the urgency of the situation. We don't know how long before a Bloodhorde battle group arrives, or how many ships it might contain, or how the intruders will affect our efforts.
The guard at the door lifted his eyebrows. Dasignal nodded, and the guard pulled the door open. A disheveled security guard looked straight at the captain.
Captain, you're needed on the bridge, urgently. We have a situation.
Haken pushed back his chair.
Excuse me?
What kind of situation?
The guard looked at the captain.
Tell him, Corporal.
The emergency oxygen conservation system went off on half a dozen decks of T5 and knocked out everyone in sickbay and the ship's administrative offices. Two people got out and gave the alarm.
I'm on my way. You'll excuse me?
I hadn't thought of that. I should have. We haven't had any experience of this sort of thing. Lieutenant Suiza, can you tell us what sort of mischief we might expect?
Esme gathered her scattered wits.
Sir, they'll try to get weapons if they don't already have them. With stolen data wands, they can find out where the ship's security weapons lockers are, and if they get a data wand keyed for security, it might even give them the access codes. Then, they'll try to isolate and immobilize large numbers of the crew, probably by locking them into various compartments. That's what Captain Hearn's allies tried to do to us on Despite. Here, I suppose they try to cut off the wings from the core. They'll damage systems that give them effective control of ship operations, environmental systems, including ventilation as they did here, hatch controls, communications, scan. I'd expect them to try to take hostages from critical positions. If they've been loose in sick bay, they'll have medical personnel and supplies, including gas exchange equipment, so that we can't use the equivalent trick on them.
And your response would be?
The same tactics would work against them if the captain initiated them. Manually reset the ship's support system so that each wing is independent for life support, as it was designed, then isolate the wings. They'll be trapped and outnumbered wherever they are. If they're not in the course section, they won't be able to get to the bridge. If they are in the course section, they won't be able to use the wings for refuge. And ship security can go through the core first, then one wing at a time until they're located. Ship security will need a different secure communication system because we have to assume the present one is already compromised.
But if we do that, we won't be able to set up for detaching T4. And if the other ships come...
We've all been knocked out with sleepy gas. We won't be able to detach T4 either.
In the brief silence that followed, Esme realized that she had just implied, no, said, that a commander was being stupid.
Lieutenant Suiza, I'm putting you in charge of security for the 14th, specifically T3 and T4. Liaise with regular ship security, but don't wait. Do what you think needs doing. Adarin, who've you got for her?
The door opened again.
They got into security. They've got the weapons and gas masks. Riot gas, probably. Maybe more.
Almost as one, heads turned to stare at Esme, who was still on her feet. Dossignol and the others scrambled up.
As I said, Lieutenant Suiza has been through this before. She correctly anticipated their moves.
I'm closing off the wings. We'll have to get the support systems isolated, but at least I've ordered the hatches closed to everything but T1. I'll give you the new codes, but...
Captain!
The guard at the door turned to look out. Esme moved before she thought. As the captain started to turn, she tackled him solidly.
Shut it!
Hey, what?
The captain writhed and tried to kick her in the head. She released him, rolled to her feet, and yanked the guard away from the door, slamming it, without taking a breath.
What?
The guard sagged to the floor, his face already bluish-gray. The captain sat up, red-faced and furious.
You...
Get him up! It's heavier than air!
If they didn't think to turn off the artificial gravity, if they didn't come right on through the locked door... Esme took the guard's weapon and used it to smash the internal door lock control. Wraith's captain and exec scrambled to help the captain up and get him to the table.
Yes, I presume.
The bridge!
After we get out of here.
Preferably before the intruders figured out where this compartment's air supply was and simply poured the gas in that way.
If we can get out of this compartment, I can suggest a safe or possibly safe route away from here. I've been all over T1 for the past quarter year.
The overhead or the deck, but I don't know how to get into it.
Well, you could just blow a hole in it.
Wraith's captain, Seska, looked up at the ceiling.
Nah, waste of ammunition. We'll go up.
He climbed onto the conference table and pushed aside one of the overhead tiles.
Yep, just like every other space station, though the one we want is over there.
It took longer than Esme wanted to get the entire group up through the hole in the overhead. The captain was still groggy and uncoordinated and made an awkward bundle to lift. Esme went last, guarding their rear with her single weapon, though she knew it would be useless if the intruders broke in. But they wouldn't. She knew that, as if she could read minds. They had isolated the captain and the highest-ranking officers, and would let them stew in there as long as they wanted. In the seconds ticking away now, they were wreaking as much havoc as they could. They'd be back at the core, trying to take the bridge, if they hadn't already. In the dim, unhandy space between the tiles of the overhead and the base of the deck above, she followed the others. Lieutenant Commander Freeze, in this instance, and wished she knew more about Lieutenant Commander Bowery. Did he really know a way out of this section? And just how had the wings been sealed off from the core? No time to worry about it. Ahead of her, the others had stopped moving. Esme squirmed around so that she could look back the way she'd come. There was nothing to see but the smudged track of their passage where they'd disturbed the dust. Someone patted her leg and she turned back. They were moving on again, more slowly. After a minute or two, she realized the leaders were slithering out of the overhead, down into a passage. When she got close enough, she could hear voices.
Damn near got us all. And you?
Freeze, in front of her, slid out the gap into helpful arms. Esme gave a last look back and saw nothing. But anyone could follow that track. She turned and dropped through feet first. A couple of enlisted men with tech schools patches replaced the overhead panel as she looked up and down the passage. Some meters in both directions, armed security guards kept watch. One of them had an armor vest and helmet, the other had none. Esme saw openings into several compartments, but no one moved that way.
Captain Haken's still having trouble breathing. Does anyone know which gas that was?
Probably SR-58. They had the antidote in the hospital, but
we can't get there.
Hey!
The shout from the outboard end of the corridor startled them. Quickly, but without panic, they moved into the nearest opening. Esme flattened against the inner bulkhead and hoped the security guards had the sense to get out of sight themselves.
Admiral Avati likes green pea and leek soup.
Carlton! In here, Major.
The Major who came through the opening was festooned with equipment. His brows went up when he caught sight of Esme and her weapon. He handed over a face filter.
The Admiral might want to put this on. They've been using sleepy gas.
They used worse than that. Captain Haken got a face full. Killed one guard.
Yes, sir. I have 10 filters with me, and Corporal Jasperson is handing them out to your security detail. Commander Bowery had suggested securing the aid stations and the weapons lockers before he went up to the meeting. We've got enough gear for about 50. Vests, helmets, comm units, weapons, and the medical supplies.
Good work. Where'd you stow it?
This way, sir.
Major Carlton led them down one passage, turned into another. Two men helped the captain along. Esme saw more guards, all with gas masks, and some with armor. She wondered where they were going, and why waste time going there instead of breaking out of T1 now before they were trapped. But she had a weapon, and she stayed back with the rear guard. Where they were going, it turned out, was a secure briefing room snugged in among the laboratories of Special Materials Research.
Separate ventilation system, good thick armor all around. It'll take them a while to get us, long enough to make plans. Any medical personnel in T1?
I've got someone coming who worked in the wing clinic. The only supplies we have are from emergency lockers because the intruders wrecked the clinic.
Captain Haken had collapsed two turns back, and now he barely roused when Lavati spoke to him.
Captain. Captain, we have a legal problem. You are the only Kosciuszko officer here. We cannot contact the others, and we need to make plans for resistance.
We're not going to resist. We're going to get the ship back.
Do it.
Thank you, Captain. I accept your permission.
In the next few minutes, the admirals agreed on the new command structure required by the emergency and on goals. Then they settled to considering how to regain control of the ship.
We need to get our combat experienced people over to T3 and T4. That's where we've got part of a ship, and might, with luck, capture a Bloodhorn ship. The sooner we get those people off on that mission, the better.
Through the blast and fire doors?
How else?
If they're smart, if they have enough men, they'll be watching all the access points.
They don't. There were only 25 of them in sickbay.
Not a complete team. They usually send a threefold pack, 3 10s.
You mean we missed some?
No. Some may have died aboard Wraith. We haven't had time to get into the foamed compartments and look. That'll be where their weapons and gear are, too.
But the thing is, they're not going to be able to watch every place we can get through, so where will they be?
Where they're still in contact with each other for backup. If they were after the bridge, and I would be, if I were trying this trick, that means they'll be watching on Deck 11, where we might be trying to get to weapons stored in the security weapons lockers and Deck 17.
So let's try Deck 8. Commander Takis can get into the core, to the secondary command center, and make sure that the FTL drive isn't working under their command. The rest of us...
Well, what do you mean, us? You aren't going out there.
I certainly am. I belong over there in the 14th with my people.
On the way down to Deck 8, they saw no sign of the intruders. Most of the people here were staff or students of the Training Command, Senior Technical Schools Division. Scattered among them were elements of the ship's crew, mostly security, and researchers from the SpecMat Research Facility. They watched, wide-eyed, as the group passed, masked and armed. Deck 8 seemed especially quiet when they came out of the stairwell. Esme, in the lead, stopped short when she saw the first body lying sprawled in the corridor.
Trouble.
And we don't know if it's gas or something else.
There was no other way from here to the firewall doors. Esme edged forward as quietly as she could.
Dead some hours.
The man had ship security patches on his shoulder, loose on one corner where someone had hacked at them but given up.
Maybe that was one of the first, and the attacker then went on to meet the others.
Esme wished they would all shut up. She could hear nothing, see nothing. At the first compartment, she looked in. 5 corpses lay sprawled on the floor, sagging from chairs onto work surfaces. Her stomach turned. Whoever had come here was quick to kill. Nearer to the core, they could see the solid wall that cut them off from the rest of the ship. Esme knew now that this was no simple bulkhead, but instead a section of the hull itself, capable of sustaining pressure if the wing detached. It lay against a similar section of the core, two thicknesses of hull. Once these barriers came down, the only way across was by means of the override codes, which could open small airlock hatches. Admiral Dossignol entered the code while the others guarded. The hatch did not move. He tried again. Again, it would not open.
Commander Ceviche, did you hear the captain give the code?
Yes, sir.
Then you try it. Perhaps I misremembered.
Ceviche also entered the number, but again the hatch did not open.
Either the captain didn't remember the right sequence, or they found a way to change it.
Or someone in the crew changed it, perhaps thinking the intruders had it.
Amounts to the same thing. Now, there's got to be another way to get through this.
Not without the equipment that's over in our section, sir. Two thicknesses of hull. We might manage one with the tools and spec mat research, but not two.
What's our communication situation?
We can reach Admiral Avadi on the headsets. So far, I've picked up nothing from the rest of the ship. That's what I'd expect with the wings closed off. We'd need higher power.
If it can't go inside, how about outside?
Same problem, getting through the hull.
Over on T3 and T4, there are airlocks on every deck.
Ceviche had projected a map of T1 on the bulkhead and was going through it deck by deck.
This one certainly isn't overprovided with airlocks. There's one out at the end of the special materials fabrication unit, of course, but...
T1 was designed to be secure from casual interference, so we have to go all the way through spec mat fab and hope no one flips the switch. Right. When I design a DSR, it's gonna have some add-ons.
This one has add-ons. That's part of the problem.
Dossignol looked around at his group.
We'd better get out there, then. I think we can assume that all the intruders are somewhere else, probably in the core section. Come on.
Dossignol strode off, startling them with his haste. Esme caught a look between Captain Seska and his exec, which suggested they weren't any happier than she was with the Admiral's assumption that they needn't worry about the intruders.
Luckily, it's on this deck.
Admiral, sir, let us catch up.
Dossignol slowed and turned.
Mark, there's...
Oh. Esme, Seska, Freeze, and Bowery hit the deck. The others stood where they'd stopped.
Down! Admiral!
Alive. And lucky.
Esme looked past Dossignol, up the passage, trying to guess where the shot had come from and what kind of weapon it was. She'd heard nothing until the impact. Ceviche crawled forward.
Very lucky.
Not for long.
The figure that stepped out was a lot closer than Esme had anticipated and loaded with weapons.
Drop your...
Esme had fired almost before she knew it. The intruder's shot ricocheted off the bulkhead as her burst took him apart from neck to hip. Esme made herself get up and move forward, past Admiral Dossignol, through the mess of splattered blood and tissue, to check the opening from which the intruder had come. It was a small compartment lined with shelves of office supplies and empty now.
Two casualties. Deck 8, main passage.
Captain Seska turned to Esme.
You're the one who was in the mutiny.
Yes, sir.
Good reaction time. If this one had a partner, we'd already know it.
Makes sense, sir.
Esme could see nothing and hear nothing but the sounds their own party made.
We could get the Admiral into cover in this closet, just in case.
By the time help arrived, they had both casualties in the closet, with Esme and the Wraith exec, Commander Freeze, watching for more trouble. Dossignol kept insisting that he was all right, that they should go on without him.
I'm not fool enough to think I should go. It'd only slow you down. But you can do nothing useful here. And over there, you might save the ship. I've dictated orders for the 14th. Lieutenant Suiza, take this to whatever officer is senior when you arrive. Now go!
Nothing hindered their movement until they reached the access area for the Special Materials Fabrication Unit. The shift supervisor for the Special Materials Fabrication Facility was a solid, graying petty chief who was not intimidated by a mere four officers.
Map can't do that. It's in use. There's 90 meters of whisker in the drum now. You'll have to have permission from Commander Dorse, and he would...
Stand aside, or there'll be 90 meters of whisker where the stars don't shine.
Admiral Dossignol will kill me if you get in there and destroy an entire batch.
No, the Blood Horde will kill you. The Admiral will only break you to pivot and then give you 20 years hard time if you don't get out of the way!
Blood Horde? What does the Blood Horde have to do with it?
Esme stepped forward, trying to project harmlessness and a pure heart.
Haven't you heard anything?
No, I haven't. I've been monitoring a startup whisker for the past 5 hours, and my relief hasn't shown up.
Bloodhorde commandos are loose on the ship, and your relief is probably dead. The only way we can fight them is to get out of T1, and the only way out of T1 is through here. I suggest you let us pass, and when we're safely out, let the Bloodhorde in if they show up. Then do a break off early.
But that'd be 90 meters wasted.
Freeze had moved to the other side of the chief from Esme.
Excuse me.
What?
Esme hoped she hadn't hit him too hard. She'd find time to feel bad about it later. They barricaded the hatch to the passage as well as they could and climbed quickly into the EVA suits in the nearby locker. They checked each other's suits before opening the first of the lockout hatches that isolated the special materials fabrication unit from the ship's artificial gravity. Inside was a metal grid walkway 10 meters long, ending in another lockout hatch. Rails ran along either bulkhead, with rings set every half meter. They went in, closed the hatch behind them, and punched for airless entry. The light ahead of them turned green, and they started down the walkway. Esme felt herself lifting with each step, as if she were walking in deepening water. In the last meter, her steps pushed her off the walkway completely, and her feet trailed back, lured by the weak attraction of Kosciusko's real mass.
I hate frickin' Zero-G.
I hate the Bloodhorde. Zero-G is just a nuisance.
They cycled through the second lockout hatch into a long, dark tube lit by the eerie purple and green glow of the growth tank. It seemed to go on and on, narrowing to a dark point far away. Here, Esme couldn't feel the slightest hint of attraction to any mass. Her stomach slid greasily up into her throat when she moved one way, and back down her spine when she turned the other way. She tried to concentrate on her surroundings. Along one side was a narrow catwalk with a rail above it.
Remind me again what happens if we disturb the growing whiskers?
They shatter and impale us with the shards.
Ah, so I guess we don't disturb them. Minimal vibration, minimal temperature variance, we slide on the rail.
Esme watched as Seska made a circle of his suit glove loosely around the rail and pushed off from the lockout hatch. He slid away and away and vanished into the darkness. Esme noticed that he'd pushed off precisely in the axis of motion he wanted. His legs simply trailed behind him.
I hope there's a bracket on the end of this thing.
Freeze did the same thing.
Lieutenant, it's my turn to be rear guard.
Esme wrapped her glove around the rail, loosened it in what she hoped was the right amount, then kicked off. It was a strange feeling. She was drawn along effortlessly, as if the rail itself were moving, and she could see nothing but the faint reflection of the greenish-purple glow on the bulkhead, a long, vague blur of not quite color. When she slowed, she didn't at first realize it. Then the blur steadied. She thought it was motionless.
Now what?
If she moved around too vigorously, she could bang into the bulkhead and disturb the whiskers. She moved very slowly, bringing her other hand to steady herself, then turning to look back the way she'd come. Far away now, she could see the little cluster of lights at the lockout hatch. Nearer, something was coming, sliding along, too fast. If Bowry hit her, they'd both hit the bulkhead, if not worse. She gripped the rail and pulled herself along, hand over hand, trying to let her body trail without twisting. She couldn't watch and move at the same time, not without twisting, and she didn't want to go too fast. She didn't know how much farther she had to go. She glanced up from time to time, matching speed with Bowry, and as he slowed in his turn, she also slowed. Somewhere ahead of her were the others. She didn't want to slam into them, either.
Slow now.
Esme hoped Bowry heard it too, but she didn't look, just put out her arm to break against her movement. Her legs slewed sideways, but she was able to stiffen her torso and keep them off the bulkhead. When she turned to look forward, she saw the narrowing, rounded end of the fabrication unit and the big, round lock that allowed completed jobs to be taken out. To one side was a smaller personnel lock. Why did they even have locks at this end, when the point of SpecMat Fab was its hard vacuum and zero-G? She thought of the answer almost as soon as the question. Of course, they didn't want all the debris in space getting into the unit. The personnel lock was manual, a simple hatch control that required only strength to turn. Then they were outside, clinging to the grab-ons and loops that Esme thought were misnamed as safety features. Beside it were a row of communications and oxygen jacks.
Top up your tanks.
Esme had almost forgotten that standard procedure. She glanced at her readouts. It hardly seemed reasonable to spend any time now for just a few percents. But the others were all plugged in. She shrugged mentally as she pushed her own auxiliary tube into place. When tank pressure reached its maximum, she pulled the connection free. Seska clipped his safety line into the first loop and started pulling himself along, up the rounded end of the fabrication unit, alongside the arching supports for the Whisker transport system. Esme followed Freeze again, with Bowery behind her, stopping to unclip and reclip her line every time it ran out. When they got to the upper surface, upper as defined by the Whisker track, Seska paused. From here, the size of Kosciusko surprised Esme all over again.
Check. Two.
Three.
Four. We'll take the transport line. It'll save us time.
Nobody mentioned how much air was left. No one had to. Esme could see on her own suit gauges that they had spent 20 minutes cycling through locks, traversing the long tunnel of the fabrication unit, climbing up this far. And now they had to go back the same distance they'd come, cross the entire ship, find a way down to one of the locks opening into T3's repair bay. Inside, walking along the decks, even running up and down ladders, they could have done it within the limits of a suit tank. Out here, it didn't matter. They had to. Seska clipped his line onto one of the rails of the transport line and pushed off. They followed. Esme had wondered how far beyond the ship's surface artificial gravity projected. As they came over the edge of T1, with the dome of the bridge ahead of them, she could feel nothing. But when she looked, her legs had drifted toward its surface. The transport track led directly over the domed core of Kosciusko, and Esme thought that if she had not been both rushed and frightened, she would have enjoyed the view. The five blunt-ended wings splayed out around them, the dome itself studded with shield generator points and an array of retractable masts for communications and remote sensing. She looked for, but could not see, any other ship shapes against the stars. The escorts were out there somewhere, but too far to occlude a noticeable patch of the starfield. It was easy to lose track of time in that long traverse of darkness. The glowing numerals inside her helmet flicked through the tenths of seconds, then seconds, then minutes. She did not look at her oxygen gauge. If it went too low too fast, there would be no helpful bomb disposal team to hook up a new one for her.
Trouble.
That was Seska. Esme looked his way. Beyond him, the star field shifted suddenly.
They're maneuvering.
Her mind froze up. But even as Seska said it, she had it figured out. Someone had decided to rotate the ship. And that someone could not be the captain. But it could very well be the Blood Horde commandos in control of the bridge.